It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Here's your daily reminder. You can find us online as well as on the radio. We maintain a website at jeffexchange.org with program topics and recordings and a look ahead to the next edition of the Jefferson Exchange. We provide similar information on our Facebook page as well. We're up to somewhere around 550 people who liked us. We'd like to really push that number up. So if you're on Facebook, come to the Jefferson Exchange page and click that like button, and that will ensure that our information will end up on your news feed on a daily basis. And the stuff we send to Facebook, which includes some social media things you expect, like some pictures and some videos, also go through to our Twitter feed. So we do maintain a Twitter feed as well. So jeffexchange.org, Facebook, and Twitter, all places to find the Jefferson Exchange online. Need to let you know about something else coming up in the news involving Jefferson Public Radio, which is that JPR and the JPR Foundation invite listeners and members from Humboldt County and surrounding areas to join us for a public reception. That will be Friday evening, next Friday, September 20th at 7 at the Eureka Theater in Eureka, California. You'll have an opportunity to learn about current and future JPR activities. You can ask questions of JPR staff and the JPR Foundation Board of Directors. That again, Friday evening, September 20th at 7 at the Eureka Theater, free of charge. If you need information on that, 541-552-6301. 552-6301. Now that I've given you that phone number, let me give you the others as well and let you know you can take part in our conversations on the exchange. Those phone numbers, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Every so often, people get into a place where they're beyond their abilities to help themselves. And if the help they need is legal help, well, it really helps further to have a few dollars to spend on a lawyer. But if a lawyer is needed and money is not available, then what? Well, the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services in Medford is one answer to that question. The organization's been around for more than 40 years now and is still going strong. Deborah Lee is here in the studio with me. She is the executive director of the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And one of the board members came as well. Professor Paul Pavlich from Southern Oregon University was with us a couple of months ago on a totally unrelated matter, but he is a board member at the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services. Paul, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, Deborah, tell us about why the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services got started in the first place.
Well, it's a long story, actually, so hopefully we'll have time.
We do.
In the early 60s, the local Jackson County Bar decided that they needed to create a committee on legal services in 1966, and Bill Dudridge was one of the leaders. And so he felt that criminal defense was necessary, and so was civil legal assistance. And so he gathered private attorneys, about 30 of them, and they would show up Friday evenings at the Jackson County Courthouse on the third floor and would talk to people who had legal problems, and they would give legal advice. And then the VISTA project came into being, and Milt Nelson from the CAP agency, Community Action Program, had an individual who did some research, and she asserted that Jackson County needed legal services and in a more structured, systematic way. And so Milt Nelson advertised that there's a position in Jackson County. And the bar and the CAP agency got together, and the bar association basically agreed that there needed to be a more formalized program, and basically endorsed the legal services being created and turned over their assets to the VISTA project.
VISTA was Volunteers in Service to America, as
That's
I recall.
That's correct.
Okay, yeah, for those of us, yeah, for just to help out the people who are too young to know that. So there was, it sounds like a lot of dedication, that original meeting, though. They get all the lawyers together on a Friday night. I'm sure just about anybody can figure out a better way to spend a Friday night than go back to the courthouse.
Well, I think they felt there was the need to give to the community as lawyers in Jackson County. And they're still involved with our program, the ones that started early on in the 60s.
So what kinds of things did that earlier version and does the current Center for Nonprofit Legal Services get involved with?
Well, I think originally they would help people with their family disputes. And so there were a lot of divorces that the private attorneys would help. And over time, when we became the Jackson County Legal Services program, that was also a concentration because there was pent-up demand for family law matters. As we matured, we actually set about specialized legal services. So we continue to do family law, especially when there's minor children involved in the marriage. We do housing and consumer matters. We handle public benefits to help people with income maintenance and access to health care. And we also do elder law, so we help with guardianships. And our newer services include immigration. And what's funny, on coming back to talk to your audience, is that 10 years ago we announced that we would be doing immigration on the Super Bowl Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And the next week we had all these people coming in, even though we had a caveat that was going to be a part-time program. So they demonstrated the community need for immigration services.
Wow. And about how many people showed up? Do you remember?
Well, we had like 50 people show up.
That's a big number.
And we were trying to figure out how to serve them because we actually had a volunteer attorney. And because of that demand, Kate Lehner decided to join our program.
Paul Pavlis, let's hear from you. How long have you been on the board at the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services?
I was trying to remember that when on the way into the studio today. I became a member of the board either 1985 or 86. I was, and consistent with legal services, I met Deborah's predecessor at a conference over in Sun River. It was in November. And I didn't have any money, and he didn't. I was camping at Sun River in the back of my pickup truck, and he knew who I was, and we got to talking at that point because we were the two people from Southern Oregon at this conference, and he said, "Would you like to be on the board?"
Now, did it stop? Did it change the name from Jackson County Legal Services because it sounded too much like a county agency?
Yes, we changed it to the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services in 87.
So over time, with the name change, has the mission changed at all, Paul?
Well, the mission has broadened. As Deborah reflected, there have been, over time, new kinds of clients, new services offered. The mission essentially remains the same, and it's to serve, to provide legal services in a non-criminal setting. In the mm-hmm. earliest stages, before I was on the board, and I guess when I was first on the board, we were still doing a little bit of criminal law, conflict cases with the public defenders, weren't we then?
Well, the public defenders did not come in existence for a while, and mm-hmm. so all
my
the
wife
private
was the initial public.
That's right.
That's 1985.
But in the early 80s, with the big recession that happened in Jackson County, the Jackson County budget was cut in support of legal services. So the then director, Phil Arnold, talked with the criminal defense bar. At that time, all lawyers that wanted to practice criminal law signed up, and they were given cases on a rotation. So the four legal services attorneys took on the criminal cases to actually help augment funding for civil legal service.
The state, the essential reason for the existence of the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services is there is no constitutional requirement that people be entitled to an attorney in civil matters. In criminal matters.
Right, you get one in criminal matters.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, after Gideon versus Wainwright,
right.
Then the state will provide attorneys and the state will compensate those attorneys. And so, as Deborah said, it was a way to, you know, what legal services has done here and everywhere is cobble together funding sources. And so people were paying for their, attorneys for legal services were helping generate revenue by doing volunteer criminal defense work, essentially.
Right, because if you get challenged in a civil suit or sued or whatever, and you can't afford the attorney, you don't get one appointed to you. This is
That's
not
correct.
Like a criminal case. Which, when I look at the timeline for the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services, I realize that when it was born, 1972 or so, the whole concept of free attorneys for criminal cases was still relatively new. Gideon versus Wainwright was less than 10 years old then, wasn't it?
That's correct.
But Bill Dutridge was the early adapter that there ought to be criminal defense and tried to do that with volunteers. And he's also the one that pushed for the civil legal assistance. And I had a public benefits case where the Court of Appeals actually said that in certain cases of entitlement, the state might need to appoint an attorney to assist.
A parental rights termination is a civil matter,
right? But it's close to criminal in the sense that you're getting your rights are terminated as a parent.
And it's an area where there is some state responsibility. And again, it's a complicated area, so the state may help. There are some pieces of that, but the general, those are exceptions to the general rule is that you're on your own on the civil side.
We are talking to the folks on the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services in Medford. Paul Pavlich is a board member. Deborah Lee is the executive director. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments, or perhaps there's a particular case that you have in mind that might be appropriate for the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Deborah, what's the most common kind of case? I mean, what's the most frequent complaint for which somebody will seek out the services of the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services?
Well, I think that the family law continues to be important. And with our focus of minor children involved with the marriage, there's also another issue of domestic violence. And so we're in the community to assist those families that are falling apart and making sure that they are safe.
So in a case of domestic violence, who's the plaintiff and who's the...
Was generally women, but men also suffer from that social ill.
So what kind of case would it be if it's a civil case and not a criminal case?
Well, they would want to be divorced, have restrainer orders if it's necessary, establish custody and visitation and support, as well as health care.
Oh, so it's possible that there could have been some kind of domestic abuse, but no criminal case attached that would by itself naturally result in a restraining order?
That's correct.
Or at least not rapidly. Everyone, all of these, Tolstoy, every family is a... is healthy in its own way, but every unhealthy family is unhealthy in its own way. every one of these is a complicated kind of situation, and it may be that the criminal justice system can deal with some, but is certainly not capable of dealing promptly or expeditiously with all of them.
So given the complications of the cases that Paul just talked about, Deborah, I mean, how many attorneys do you have, and how far along in their careers are they generally?
Well, we have 5.5 full-time equivalent attorneys. And there are at least 3 attorneys that have 30 years or more experience. And we have 2 attorneys that are 10 to 7 years. And then most recently we have two young attorneys that recently graduated from law school.
So and this is their only job working for NAWA, or do they
This is a staff attorney model, which means that they work for the nonprofit, and we don't encourage moonlighting because it's already a demanding work.
And I imagine there's a lot of hours then, especially when we talk about the complexity of the cases.
Well, most of us show up at the office, but we also work into the evenings if necessary.
So do you do some of the legal work yourself, or are you strictly the administrator?
I have a caseload of about 100. I help the elderly with guardianships and with issues of health care.
Now, you're talking about some of the issues that goes on. Housing and consumer is one of the areas in which the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services focuses. Is there a fair amount of landlord-tenant dispute stuff that comes your way?
Well, our focus is to make sure that people are not homeless, and that is a huge issue. And so we're in the courts, and we're also working to settle cases so that people can stay in their home. And with the recession, we've had increasing numbers of housing cases. The foreclosures also affect renters. And in the consumer matters, there's an increased number of collections, especially against the elderly and the disabled. And so we're vigilant in making sure that there's not any fraud or overzealous collection efforts being made on these folks. Generally, if they get public benefits, their income is exempt from collections.
Interesting, but the people who are doing the collection probably don't generally make that known.
Well, if they attempt to garnish their funds, and Social Security is the only deposit, have been increasing protective orders from the legislature saying you cannot take that money. And that's some of the advocacy done by legal services programs in Oregon.
This sounds like a fairly scary set of situations sometimes. I mean, if you're thinking, oh, my God, they're going to take some of my money away. I can barely afford to stay in my house as it is. I need to fight this. I don't know how. I certainly can't afford a lawyer. So people must come fairly rattled when they come to the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services. So it must take a special kind of hand to be able to calm them down, smooth things over, and get into the specifics of
and
the case.
And that's what we do besides do litigation. We counsel people about what their rights are and what they can do as their own advocate. And it ends up being that we have more informed consumers in our valley.
So of the people who come to see you, do the majority then end up taking the work or doing some of the paperwork and whatever else they need to do to get their situation corrected by themselves, or the majority handled by the attorneys?
Well, unfortunately, we cannot help everyone who comes to the office. So in 2012, we had 1,600 cases that we accepted and helped resolve. And we only accept 2/5 of the applications that come in.
Okay, so if I'm doing my math correctly, you have about 4,000 applications over the course of a year?
Correct.
Okay.
And some of the cases are extended. They could take, for Social Security disability cases, it could take 2 years before they can get a hearing. And so in the meantime, we're working to create the record so that we can establish that that person's disabled.
What's the average amount of time, though, that people will spend connected to the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services? I imagine some of the things that don't involve the Social Security Administration or any other federal agency might be resolved a bit faster than that.
Well, usually the landlord-tenant, they're summary proceedings, so that happens quite rapidly, like within 2 weeks.
Because they have to go to court to answer an eviction notice or something?
Correct.
You know, that point you brought up a few minutes ago, though, is a really interesting one that I don't think a lot of people thought about. I mean, when we think about foreclosures, we tend to think about the people who own the house, living in the house, ending up on the sidewalk. But it affects renters, too, because if the landlord's not paying the mortgage on the building and it gets foreclosed, they're out.
That's correct. And there are legal protections in terms of what kinds of notices are required, and the individuals are allowed to stay longer. They have a longer notice period, so they're allowed to stay longer. And sometimes there's actually requirements for relocation expense.
Okay, so the renters, then, well, because it sounds like certainly if somebody's being foreclosed upon and they don't even live in the house, the chances of them relaying the information to the renter are probably slim.
There's required notice.
There's required notice. By the landlord?
By the service.
By the one doing the serving of the notice of foreclosure.
Well, if the banks are foreclosing, they're required to give notice.
But it sounds like this is, and I think you already mentioned that this has been a bit of a growth area since the recession, is that, you know, since we've heard so much about foreclosures where there's not sufficient information given to the people being foreclosed, things are happening much faster, et cetera.
Well, you know, family law used to be 50% of our total caseload, and in 2012 it was 46%. And housing and consumer moved up to 42%. So it's been a very active case type.
Paul Pavlich, being on the board as long as you've been at the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services, where do you see things going in the future? Is it more of the same, or are there other areas you might consider expanding into?
Well, we would consider lots of areas, but we do not have the luxury of servicing. I mean, it's always been kind of a triage. What kinds of issues, what kinds of problems can we give the most bang for our buck, if you will. I remember when we added immigration as a service, it was sort of like saying, well, which child is going out of the rowboat now? You know, it's not really something that we can do with a great deal of without a real strategic plan of how we're going to accommodate or fund this, you know, accommodate our current caseload or fund an addition to it. And so as Deborah indicated, there is some vacillation in the nature of the caseload, just in consistent with whatever the economic pressures or social political pressures. But I think we're kind of with a core right now.
Right. As times change, you have to change with what the requirements are. Got it. Paul Pavlich is a board member. Deborah Lee, the executive director at the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services in Medford. What's the website?
www.cnpls.org.
CNPLS.org. All right. Thank you so much.